If you are listening to this file, you have my gratitude. My name is Sam Gabriel. I'm a white guy from suburban central Texas who's taken it upon himself to make audiobooks out of this series of Harry Potter fanfictions because I'm very cool. Five chapters in the fourth book of this series take place within the Navajo Nation, referred to in the book as Dineta. The main character, a white teenage girl named Alexandra, has gone there to pursue her nemesis and is fairly out of her depth culturally and in any other respect as well. Which is great because I'm also completely out of my depth in trying to read Navajo characters. I apologize for the length of this file as well. I cut out everything that wasn't really relevant to why you're listening to it, but I didn't want to cut out so much that it's unclear what's happening and it's just a boring mishmash of dialogue that is incomprehensible. So, you know, these five chapters are over 3 hours of audio normally, so I got it down by half. Of the characters present in what you are about to listen to, the most prominent is Henry Tsotsi. He lives in Dineta and is a sort of grizzled middle-aged type, so his accent is pretty pronounced. The second most prominent, John Mamelito, is a Navajo teenager who is a recurring villain in the story, having debuted two books prior to this one. I never saw him as having much of an accent, partially because he is one of the youngest Navajo characters, and his character thematically is one who strays from the reservation when it suits him and only respects Navajo culture as far as it directly helps him, and partially because in book two I didn't want to try to learn the accent yet. I have cut from this file scenes where he is the only Navajo character speaking. Another note is that the group of teenagers that Alexandra, the protagonist, encounters in the library, I see as having no real accent to speak of, again because of their age, but in the scene in which they appear, they are playing up what accent they do have in order to mess with the white girl, which is the purpose of the scene. One of the boys does appear later, but I cut those parts out of this file as well, since he isn't speaking with an accent when he appears again. Two characters from other tribes appear in this file as well. The first Native American to speak is a Ute, and the medicine woman Billy Tebowina is a Hopi. I don't know how to differentiate those accents, so I didn't especially try. I just sort of turned it down a little bit. Please let me know if that's offensive. Please let me know if anything I'm doing here is offensive. That's why you're listening to it. The town of Orange Rock and its attendant rock formation was based on Shiprock, New Mexico, loosely, and Witch's Rock was invented for the purposes of the story. A final note, the person who has given you this file has been immensely helpful in providing me with reference videos and pronunciation resources, but I want to make it clear that anything good about this recording is owed to her, and anything embarrassingly bad is still my fault. I still don't have that clear an idea of what I'm doing. Thanks again, and I hope you enjoy. A truck carrying bottled water pulled over after Alexandra had walked about a quarter of a mile. The driver was a long-haired Native American, youngish but wearing a conservative long-sleeved shirt beneath a brown vest. He gave her a bemused smile.
"If you're trying to get to Albuquerque, you're going the wrong way," he said, jerking his thumb behind them.
"I'm not," Alexandra said. "I'm trying to get to Orange Rock." The driver raised his eyebrows.
"Why would you be going to Orange Rock?"
"I have a friend there. I promised I'd visit him this winter. He didn't believe I'd come."
"So you're hitchhiking your way to a little town in the middle of the Navajo Nation? How old are you?"
18. He laughed.
"Hell, you are."
After considering her a moment, he reached over and opened the door.
"Get in."
She climbed in, making sure her body was blocking his view of her hand, which was in her pocket, holding her wand. The driver was friendly enough. His name was Pete Chimborus. Although they were driving onto the Navajo Reservation, Pete was a Ute, originally from Utah. He didn't say much more about that, but he was quite curious about her. She told him her name was Carol Green, and stuck to her story about being a university freshman, but mumbled evasive answers when he pressed her further. After a while, he stopped asking her questions and told her a little about the local area. When they arrived at Orange Rock, though, he said,
"So your boyfriend's an Indian?"
"I didn't say he was my boyfriend."
"Right, your friend,"
he grinned.
"Is he expecting you?"
"No, it will definitely be a surprise."
"I'll bet. Well, he'll know you're here soon enough."
"I hope not," she thought. But she thanked him for the ride as he pulled to a stop in front of a large, flat building that appeared to be a gas station, general store, and supermarket.
"Don't get caught hitchhiking on tribal lands," he said. "Those Navajo cops can be real assholes."
"I'll remember that. Thanks." She hopped to the ground. Pete Chimborazo strove his pallets of water bottles around to the back of the store, while Alexandra took a look around.
"Where are you going?" asked the man behind the counter. He was an Indian. Everyone in the store was an Indian.
"To the Four Corners Monument," Alexandra said, since the Four Corners Monument was more or less in the right direction.
"How are you getting there?" the man asked.
"Hiking."
"Hiking?"
He took off his hat and ran a hand through his hair.
"Little girl, that's 30 miles on a straight line, and nearly twice that on the highway."
"Do you have any hiking maps?"
He shook his head.
"That's not hiking territory. You and your folks want to go hiking. Go to the Mesa Cliffs National Park."
He pointed at a spot on the map she was examining.
"Thanks," she said, folding the map and putting it back in the rack.
"There's a visitor's rack at the library," he added.
"Library? You've got a library here?"
The man pointed down the road. "Little blue building between the Texaco and the land use office, a block that away."
"Thanks," she said, more enthusiastically. "I'll tell my folks."
There was an old book with a faded red cover that the librarian said showed some of the historical grazing areas, sheep trails, and borders that shifted every time the government changed reservation boundaries.
"Probably the most detailed maps you'll get," the woman said, "but once you leave the highways, you can't really find your way around unless you know the area. You're not from around here, are you?"
It could not have been more obvious that Alexandra wasn't from around here, so she said,
"I'm visiting a friend, but he's taking care of his sheep."
She'd read that Navajo were big sheep herders.
"So I thought I'd kill some time at the library."
The librarian made a hmm sound and went back to her desk. Alexandra was surprised but relieved when the woman didn't press further. The teenagers were still staring at her and whispering. She sat down and studied the big map that unfolded from the folio-sized book, comparing it with the map Quimley had given her. It looked like the place where John Mammolito had built his house was not even in sheep grazing territory, nor was it within the boundaries of any of the oil and natural gas fields that dotted the region. It was almost 100 square miles of uninhabited desolation. Two of the teenage boys turned their chairs around to face Alexandra from across her table. With casual arrogance, they looked over her and the map she was studying. Alexandra guessed that they were 16 or 17. One of them had a handsome face and short hair, unlike his friend, whose face was pockmarked with acne and whose hair hung in a long black fringe around his head. They were both wearing heavy flannel jackets. The long-haired boy had a wool cap covering the top of his head, despite the fact that they were indoors. She eyed the two of them, saying nothing but wishing she knew a convenient spell to banish teenage boys.
"What are you doing here?" the handsome boy asked in a low voice. There was nothing hostile in his tone, but it was clear that he wasn't just asking what she was doing in the library.
"Visiting a friend," Alexandra said.
"What's your friend's name? Maybe we know him."
"Yeah, we Indians all know each other," the long-haired boy nodded sagely.
Alexandra glanced at the other table, where the other teens were now doing a very bad job of pretending to study the books in front of them. There were two more slightly younger boys and three girls. All of them were older than Alexandra, though a couple of them perhaps only by a year or two.
"I doubt it," she said. "He's not really local."
"You mean he's not Diné?" the short-haired boy asked, with the same air of concerned interest. Alexandra knew better than to make a scene in a library, so she kept her voice low.
"No offense, but I don't know you, and you don't know me, so..."
"That's true. That's why we noticed you right away." The boy pointed at his cheek and at her, as if to emphasize his keen perception. "Strangers on the res are kind of suspicious."
"You never know who might be a witch," the other boy said.
Alexandra sat up straight.
"A witch?
You've heard of witches, right?" The first boy lowered his voice, glancing in the librarian's direction.
"We call them skinwalkers."
Alexandra felt a chill.
"But, wait, you don't really believe in witches, do you?"
The librarian looked up, and the boy frantically waved his hands, indicating Alexandra should be quieter.
"You never know," the long-haired boy said.
His friend nodded.
"Strange things happen at night out in the desert."
"Like what?" Alexandra asked. The two boys leaned forward. The teens at the next table were leaning closer too, no longer even pretending that they weren't listening in.
"They say witches can transform into animals and fly, but you don't want to be caught by one. They do terrible things. It gives us nightmares just thinking about the last bodies they found."
"Bodies?" Alexandra swallowed. "People have been killed?"
"Strangers, usually. Especially Biligan. What did the police say? Alexandra asked. The first boy snorted. Come on. Cops are never going to admit someone was killed by a witch. Not even Navajo cops. Not even when they're found with the soles of their feet cut off and their internal organs stolen, the second boy said gravely. Alexandra was paler than usual, remembering Quimley's tale of finding skins and entrails in John Mammolito's house.
Quimley does not think they were all from animals.
Hey, don't worry. If you stay around here, you'll be safe, the first boy said. Just don't get caught alone out there at night when the moon comes up, said the second boy. I'm not going to be out anywhere at night, Alexandra said, knowing she intended just that. That's good. You know, you could hang out with us. Until your friend shows up, I mean.
Alexandra frowned. Thanks for the invitation, but...
It would be for your own protection, the boy persisted. We could keep an eye on you, make sure you're not a witch, and we could also protect you against witches and... He lowered his voice still further.
Vampires.
Vampires? Alexandra exclaimed, and ducked her head when the librarian glared at her again.
At the next table over, the other teen's eyes were wide. One of the girls had put a hand to her mouth.
Shh, one of the other girls said. Maybe we shouldn't tell her, the long-haired boy said.
Alexandra looked between them.
Tell me what? It's an ancient tribal secret,
the short-haired boy said. He looked over his shoulder at his friends as if to get their confirmation. No one said anything, so he turned back to her.
We don't usually tell outsiders. You see, we're a very special band of Indians. Very ancient and mystical, his friend said. Since before the white man came, it's been our sacred duty to protect other humans from witches and vampires. That's why we have the magical ability to turn into wolves.
Alexandra stared at him. He stared earnestly back at her.
Wait a minute, she said. Vampires suck, said the other boy.
The girl whose hand was over her mouth doubled over, gasping and sputtering. There was an explosion of laughter from the other teenagers. The two boys' mouths twitched, and the handsome one's face split into a grin that he could no longer hold back, while the homelier boy leaned forward, bending his head over the table and slapping it with the palm of his hand.
"This is a library, not your homeroom class or the burger barn," the librarian said, while Alexandra turned redder and redder.
"Sorry, Mrs. Begay,"
one of the girls said. Alexandra stood up, put the book of maps back onto the shelf hard enough to provoke another stormy look from the librarian, and slung her backpack over her shoulder.
"Oh, come on, don't leave," said the laughing storyteller.
"Screw you," she hissed.
"White girl likes you," said his friend.
Hands grabbed her ankles and hurled her feet upward. She threw her arms out to keep from being planted to the ground face first and rolled over, just in time for her adversary to descend on her. A knee landed in her stomach, knocking all the wind out of her and almost making her vomit. A large, heavy hand caught the wrist of her wand hand and held it pinned to the ground, but it was the knife that caught her attention as it gleamed in the moonlight and then was pressed against her neck.
"Now one word," the man said breathlessly. "Don't make me cut your throat."
She couldn't have said a word if she'd wanted to. His knee was frantically forcing her diaphragm off her throat, and she couldn't breathe.
"Let go of your wand," he said. "Easy now, just let go of it."
It was hard to obey. His grip on her wrist was hard enough to grind bones together. She forced her fingers to open, and the wand slipped out of them. Immediately, the man on top of her snatched it away and rose to his feet, grabbing the front of her cloak and yanking her to her feet as well. She gulped air and was prevented from doubling over only by her assailant's iron grip. Tears of pain were streaming down her cheeks. She couldn't say anything for a moment, then, eyeing the knife, decided she'd rather die quickly than with the soles of her feet cut off. She kicked desperately with her knee, followed by an attempt to stomp his feet, but he anticipated both motions and flung her to the ground. The impact knocked the breath out of her again.
"You are one crazy girl," he said. "Are you trying to make me kill you?"
The moon was bright in the sky, so she could see the man's features. He had long black hair, a prominent nose and cheekbones, dark skin and a headband around his head. Definitely Native American, but he was not John Mammolito.
"You're not going to kill me?"
she said, dazed. She could feel her wand lying only a yard away and started to roll toward it, only for the man's heavy boot to pin her shoulder painfully against the ground.
"You sure make it tempting," he said. "Is that what Aurors do where you're from? Here in Dinata, we don't kill damn fool kids if we can help it. You give me one more bit of trouble, though, and I'll put a transfiguration on you that you didn't learn in your Bilagana school.
Oros? Alexandra repeated, feeling as foolish as she had at the library, with a lot more injury added to insult. You're an Auror?
Enmitozzi, he said. Dineta Auror Authority. And you're under arrest.
In retrospect, Alexandra thought that keeping her mouth shut would probably have been smarter than asking, what for? She didn't know where Henry Tsotsi went after leaving her sitting uncomfortably on the cold, hard ground, wrapped in silver ropes. He'd taken her wand and her pack, and then he'd taken a leather pouch off his belt, turned it upside down, and dumped a 4-foot rattlesnake on the ground in front of her. It coiled up and raised its head, and immediately began vibrating its tail with a sound that triggered an instinctive reaction. Alexandra pushed herself backward away from the snake, but the Dine Auror stood behind her, blocking her retreat.
Stay put and don't move. It won't bite you, unless you antagonize it, he said.
Are you nuts? Alexandra asked in a low voice.
I'll be back. Don't worry, if you make it bite you, we'll probably get you an anti-venom potion in time.
Back from where? This is totally child endangerment. Her only answer was a pop, and then she almost fell backward. The snake buzzed again. Alexandra shivered. Tsotsi hadn't taken her boots away. Maybe she could get rid of the snake with an improvised charm, and then, what, take off across the desert without her wand, arms tied to her sides? I like snakes, honest, she mumbled. The snake's head swiveled side to side, and it gave another warning rattle. She sat still until the snake stopped buzzing. It should be hibernating right now, she thought. It probably wasn't very happy about being left out in the cold. Bruised, bloody, blistered, and exhausted, she began to feel like it wouldn't matter if the snake did bite her. She was more worried about what John Mammolito and his fellow witches were up to. Nonetheless, she found herself nodding off. Her head tilted forward and her eyes closed. She jerked awake when she heard a pop again, and then Henry Tsotsi was leaning over her.
Well, I'll be damned, he said.
Alexandra became conscious of a weight sliding against her chest and belly. She gulped, her throat suddenly very dry. The big rattlesnake had slithered beneath the magical ropes and coiled up inside her jacket. She feared it would be disturbed now by the thumping of her heart. It didn't start buzzing until Tsotsi slid his hand down the front of her jacket. Watch it, Alexandra said, but he snatched the snake out deftly without touching her or provoking it to strike.
I gave it some of my body heat before I left, he said, but it must have liked yours more.
He held open the pouch at his side and dumped the snake inside. I have a snake familiar, too, Alexandra said, except mine's not poisonous.
It's not my familiar. We don't have familiars.
Tsotsi looked at his hand and frowned.
You're bleeding.
You didn't notice while you were beating me up?
While I was deflecting your curses, you mean?
I didn't know you were an Auror. I thought you were a dark wizard. It was self-defense. The Navajo wizard produced his wand and cast a light spell. Alexandra was a little disappointed that he used the same Lumos incantation that other wizards used. He took a closer look at her face. Why did you leave me here? She asked.
We were inspecting your handiwork.
You mean John Mammolito's house? The fire?
His grave expression turned graver.
What do you know about John Mammolito?
He's a dark wizard.
A friend of yours?
Hell no! I came here to arrest him.
Arrest?
Henry Tsotsi's thick black eyebrows scrunched up.
What territory makes children Aurors?
I mean, like, a citizen's arrest.
Tsotsi gave her a blank look in response.
I was going to capture him, then call the WJD, Alexandra said.
She didn't think he believed her. He hauled her to her feet and fastened a hand around her upper arm. Without warning, they apparated. It did nothing for Alexandra's already disoriented and shaken state. She would have fallen to her knees if he hadn't held her up when they reappeared just off the edge of a dark desert highway. A few feet away, moonlight shined down on a large pickup truck. Tsotsi opened the passenger side door.
Get in.
Can you untie me?
No.
She stared at him, but when she saw he wasn't joking, she stepped up into the cab and squirmed into the seat with difficulty. At least it was more comfortable than the desert floor. He slammed the door shut and walked around the truck, then slid behind the steering wheel and started the engine.
Look, I'm really sorry, she said. I told you, I didn't know you were an Auror.
What are you doing here?
I told you, I was looking for John Mammolito.
To arrest him.
Henry Tonsi's expression was neutral, but his tone was skeptical.
How did you know where John Mammolito's hogan was?
An elf told me. Tonsi turned on the headlights, then rubbed his head as they rolled onto the highway. He'd done that several times now. She supposed disarming him and dropping him on his head might explain some of his unfriendliness.
Do you know how much trouble you're in?
He asked. You have no idea.
I think I do. John Mammolito had a witch's heart even before he went to Charmbridge Academy. Then he came back, and now he consorts with Navajo and Bilagana witches. You think just because you're in the Indian territories, you can get away with practicing witchcraft here?
What's wrong with being a witch? Do Indians only let men practice magic? Tsotsi glanced sideways at her. They passed a sign that said Orange Rock was 10 miles ahead.
I don't mean witch the way you do, he said. We call anyone who practices evil magic, dark arts, as you Bilagana call it, a witch.
What do you call a Bilagana girl with a wand, then?
Trouble. The Auror shook his head. You're a fool if you think Mammolito won't cut out your heart the moment it suits him. And when I turn you over to the Wizard Justice Department, your fate won't be much better. Help me find him, and I'll speak for you as best I can.
Wait, you think I'm his girlfriend or something? Alexandra was so angry for a moment that she couldn't speak. John Mammolito tried to kill me! He came to Charmbridge Academy in my hometown to get at me! I came here to get him! Tsotsi didn't say anything. I'm not a witch, Alexandra said. I mean, I am, but not a Navajo witch! I mean, obviously I'm not a Navajo, but you know what I mean! Tsotsi remained silent. Where are you taking me? She asked.
Orange Rock.
What are you going to do with me?
First, get some healing potions and burn salve for your injuries. Then figure out what you're really doing here. Why did you set John Mammolito's hogan on fire?
I was attacked by some kind of baby mummy with a monster head that he left there. The skin around Tsotsi's mouth and eyes tightened. She didn't think he bought that any more than the mention of an elf. Aren't you even going to search the remains of his house? She asked.
Other Aurors are there now. If they find a baby mummy, they'll let me know.
Why didn't you arrest him already?
We've been hunting for John Mammolito and his fellow witches for months. How did you find him?
I told you—
An elf.
Why are you asking me questions if you're not going to believe me? He kept driving. They were not heading toward the town of Orange Rock. They were heading for the towering rock itself, the immense landmark that cast a ruddy orange reflection, even in the moonlight. If you didn't know where John's house was, how did you find me? She asked.
The trace.
Alexandra was startled. The trace?
You attacked someone in Farewell, broke into a motel, then cast more spells as soon as you got to Orange Rock. You'd left the library before I got there, but it wasn't hard to figure out who the white girl was that everyone was talking about. Apparently you think the rules about underage use of magic don't apply in the Indian territories.
You trace underage witches and wizards too?
Not ours, but we like to know when strangers come into Dineta and start waving their wands around. I picked up your trace from Central Territory.
Maybe if you'd been tracing John Mammolito before he got kicked out of Charmbridge Academy, you'd have known what he was up to, Alexandra said bitterly. The Auror was silent for a long time after that. They left the highway and began driving along a dirt road toward the massive formation rising out of the desert floor. Is your headquarters under Orange Rock? She asked. He slammed on the brakes. Alexandra hadn't been able to put her seatbelt on with her arms bound to her sides, and Tsotsi hadn't put it on for her, so her face almost went into the dashboard before he grabbed her.
Why would you ask that?
He demanded. She blinked at him. I saw in the maps and geography books at the library, Orange Rock is like a big sacred site for Navajos, right? So maybe it was a place of power for Indian wizards before the Confederation sealed it off. Tsotsi began driving again. They didn't drive directly to the massive rock, however. When they were about a mile from it, they went off-road and detoured around it, heading toward a much smaller rock formation. It was an impressive landmark in its own right, towering hundreds of feet above the desert floor like the jagged spines of some ancient, petrified monster. But dwarfed in proximity to Orange Rock, it was easy to overlook. The old, battered, double-wide trailer sitting next to it looked entirely out of place, like a discarded beer can. Tsotsi drove right up to it and parked next to the only other vehicle, an old gray jeep. Alexandra squinted at the trailer and tried to see it as a muggle,
which now that she'd gotten used to seeing as a witch was harder to do. It was not so much a matter of turning off her witch sight, but looking at what was there if she ignored it. Without her witch sight, only the jeep stood out in the jumble of rocks. "That's kind of an ugly thing to use as a wizard meeting place," she said.
"Yes, it is."
Tsotsi got out of the truck and came around to open her door, and helped her out a little bit more gently than when he dragged her into the truck. "Why don't you make it one of those round, traditional buildings?" she asked.
"A hogan."
He gripped her upper arm and led her to the door of the trailer. Alexandra wasn't surprised when he opened the door, and the interior was, in fact, a vast round chamber that was much larger than the trailer outside. They stepped into what seemed to be a mud-walled dwelling of great size, with a hard-packed dirt floor and openings leading off to other chambers. Some of these had dirt floors, but in one Alexandra saw sand that didn't match the color of the desert outside. There were men and women moving around between the rooms, all of them Indians, mostly dressed in practical Muggle clothing, though Alexandra saw a few beaded vests and one man carrying a long wooden stick that could have been a wand, except that it was too thick and had an eagle's claw at one end. Henry Tsotsi led Alexandra into a small, round room with a bench and a cot. It took her a moment to realize that it was a prison cell. He gestured with his wand, and the silver ropes around her loosened and fell off, disappearing before they hit the ground. He stepped back into the larger room outside and cast a spell that caused a glowing line to materialize across the threshold.
"Age line," he said. "Don't try to leave."
"I have to go to the bathroom," Alexandra said.
"I'll have a healer here shortly. Once she examines you, you can use the facilities."
He noted the expression on her face, and for the first time, he showed a hint of a smile.
"I suppose you thought you'd have to use a clay pot or a hole in the ground."
She glared at him, but he was already walking away. She tested the age line, of course. Not that she would try to escape or even leave her cell, but she had to test it. She held a hand out cautiously and felt neither pain nor resistance. She could reach outside the room. She tried taking a step, and at the point where her balance would have shifted over the line, she was stopped by an invisible barrier. She leaned against it and found herself held up by the barrier. It seemed pretty effective. She couldn't help wondering what would keep her from apparating out or trying to go through the walls if she knew the right spells, and if she had her wand. She supposed they had ways to prevent that as well. She lay down on her back on the cot and stared up at the brown mud ceiling. Contemplating escape was just something to occupy her mind anyway. She had no idea what she was going to do now. She didn't nod off this time. She was in too much pain. Her face and hands hurt, and so did the scratches and bruises where the creature in John Mambolito's hogan had clawed and bitten her. When a woman walked into the room, Alexandra turned her head in the newcomer's direction, but barely had the strength or will to sit up, so she didn't.
"You tested the age line," the woman said. She was about Claudia's age. She had lighter skin than Henry Tsotsi, and was wearing a long black dress with a red and white shawl twisted around her shoulders. She had blue cloth wrapped around her wrists, and her jet black hair was tied up in a bun with red string.
"How do you know?" Alexandra asked. Amused, the woman leaned over her and took a strand of Alexandra's hair and tugged at it to hold in front of Alexandra's eyes. It was white.
"It turned my hair white?" Alexandra groaned. "Is that permanent?"
The woman smiled faded. "Henry just left you lying here, covered in blood and blisters?"
"I think I made him angry."
The woman's expression was serious now. "Consorting with witches will make people angry in these parts. You're a foolish little girl. Do you have any idea what you're messing with?" She put a hand beneath Alexandra's shoulder. "Sit up, please." She brought a leather purse into the room with her, which she now unslung and set on the floor. She proceeded to take potion bottles out of it. Alexandra told her, "I wasn't consorting with witches. I came here to bring John Mambolito to justice for what he did to me and my friends. I don't understand why you're assuming I'm an evil witch. None of you have even asked me my name."
"Your name is Alexandra Quick."
The woman smiled at Alexandra's startled reaction. "We went through your pack. Henry has contacted the Central Territory Trace Office now. We'll know all about you soon enough. My name is Billy Tewawina, by the way." She displayed a long, thin wand with bits of colored paint at the end of it, and conjured a plain, woven curtain that materialized in the air and hung across the doorway without visible support. "I think you'll need to take your clothes off if you want me to heal all those wounds." Alexandra peeled off her jacket, and then a little more reluctantly took off her shirt and her pants, after very carefully sliding off her 7-leg boots and setting them on the cot next to her. Tebowina sucked on her lower lip when she saw the raw, bloody patch of skin just below Alexandra's navel and the gash in her neck. "Lie down," she said, and Alexandra did. Tebowina cast a spell Alexandra recognized as a basic blood-clotting charm on her neck, then poured some oil on the lower wound and rubbed it against her. It stung at first, and Alexandra winced. "Something evil did this," Tebowina said. "No kidding." Alexandra showed the healer her wrist, which was bruised and cut from the creature's beak, and then pointed at her knee. It was this mummy or skeleton, but it was the size of a child. "It attacked me." She stopped when she saw Billy Tibowina's horrified reaction. "What?" Tibowina muttered something in a language Alexandra didn't recognize. Then she said in English, "I need to tell Henry about this." "I tried to. He didn't believe me." The healer put burn salve on Alexandra's face and hands and used charms and lotions on all the bruises and cuts she'd acquired from ankle to shoulder. "Some of these will leave scars, even with magic," Tibowina said. "You'll have a scar here." She laid a fingertip gently on the skin of Alexandra's lower belly. "And here?" She pointed at Alexandra's neck. "And probably here," she added, holding up Alexandra's wrist. "Though the cut is not deep, and a blessing just might rid your flesh of the evil." "Like an Indian blessing?" Alexandra asked. "Like that, yes. Don't worry. I learned the same magical theory and healing arts you colonials do." "I wasn't worried, and I'm not a colonial." Tebowina looked with amusement and a little sympathy at the nearly naked girl on the cot. "You are one pale, pale face. And you're a pale face witch, which makes you a colonial." "Oh," Alexandra sighed. "You guys really don't like white people much, do you?" Tebowina laughed. "Some of my best friends are white people." She waved her wand and conjured a robe, which she handed to Alexandra. "I think this will be more comfortable than these burnt, bloody things." "Thank you." Alexandra took the robe. While she put it on, she asked, "So what's going to happen to me?" "I'm going to tell Henry about your injuries. I suppose he'll have some more questions for you. I don't know why you came here, but you're a foolish girl." This had already been said, and Alexandra had already answered, so she didn't reply this time. Tebowina got to her feet. "Can I use the bathroom?" Alexandra asked. Tebowina sucked on her lip again, then nodded. "Don't make trouble. I'm a healer, not an auror, but I can still curse you good." She leaned closer and whispered in Alexandra's ear, "Special Indian curses." The healer banished the age line and walked her through the doorway. Alexandra didn't get to see much more of the interior of this strange headquarters, as the restroom turned out to be right next to her cell. It had ordinary tile flooring and plumbing no different from that at Charmbridge. Then led Alexandra back to her cell and cast an age line, just as Henry Tsotsi had. "If you're smart, you'll cooperate with Henry and have nothing to do with John Mammolito or any other two-heart Navajos," she said. "Thanks," Alexandra said. "When Navajos go bad, they go really bad," Tebowina said, and left Alexandra alone. Keeping an eye on the doorway, Alexandra took the map and the scrap of vellum that she had recovered from John Mammolito's house out of her pocket. The map had been opened and folded to a section of desert to the west of Orange Rock, near the Arizona border. Alexandra studied the map and the charred piece of vellum, trying to correlate what had been on the now incinerated portion with the features of the topographical map. There was a small range of flattened hills extending in a roughly northwesterly direction that might have been the valley on the vellum map, and the tower, she thought John had drawn, seemed to be located in the hard terrain north of the hills, at the base of a mountain range that rose up to fold into the Rockies. Between them was nothing but high desert. She put the pieces back into her pocket and lay back on the cot. She rolled her singed jacket, still smelling of smoke, under her head and fell asleep. She woke when someone kicked her cot. She roused and sat up, and found herself looking up at the unfriendly face of Henry Tsotsi. He dumped some clothes in her lap.
"They should fit you, more or less. Get dressed. You won't really fit in wearing robes on the reservation. Not that you're going to be here very long."
"Where am I going?" Alexandra asked, looking at the jeans and long-sleeved pullover, both of them a little large for her and faded with wear.
"Back to Central Territory."
"What?" Alexandra couldn't read the Auror's expression.
Apparently you're well known back home. A special Inquisitor, Diana Grimm, will be waiting to pick you up at the Portkey Station personally. I'm guessing you know her, since she obviously knows you.
Yeah, I know her. Alexandra's fingers dug into the clothes on her lap. So just like that, you're going to send me back by Portkey? What about John Mammolito?
John Mammolito is our problem.
He's not just your problem, he's...
Yes, we appreciate you coming to Dinata to catch Dark Wizards for us. We Indians can always use help from 14-year-old white girls. But we'll take it from here. Come on.
Sonsi turned his back on her and walked out of the room. She followed him, and he pointed at the restroom.
Use the facilities if you have to, and change. We have a long drive ahead of us, and I don't plan to stop.
Alexandra went into the restroom and put on the pants and shirt under the robes Billy Tebowina had given her. As she expected, they were loose on her. When she emerged, the Navajo Auror walked outside. She followed him sullenly. The jeep was gone, but his pickup truck was there. The sun was up, and high enough that Alexandra realized she must have slept longer than she'd thought. She'd been able to wash her face in the restroom, but she hadn't had a shower since the previous evening in the motel room. She felt grimy and sweaty. Her stomach rumbled when she smelled cooked food upon opening the door to the truck. Tsonsi gestured at a paper bag sitting on the divider between the front seats.
Breakfast. Enjoy it. We won't be stopping to eat along the way.
She got into the truck and asked, What about my backpack and my wand?
Your backpack is back there.
Tsonsi gestured with a thumb at the truck bed behind them.
Minus a couple of the illegal items. I have your wand. I'll give them both back to you just before you take the portkey back to Central Territory.
The paper bag contained a fat breakfast burrito wrapped in foil and a cup of hot tea. Alexandra unwrapped the burrito and said, Thank you. For the food, I mean. Tsotsi grunted as they headed away from the trailer. Orange rock cast a long shadow over them. Seen up close in the daylight, it was even more magnificent than it had been at night, with enormous spurs of rock thrusting hundreds of feet out of the ground. Most of its upper ridge was made up of jagged, toothy stone formations along a quarter-mile profile, except for a slightly flat area at the very crown of the monument, with a straight lip overlooking the desert between it and the town named after it. Alexandra thought she could feel power residing in its stony heart, but she wasn't sure that wasn't her imagination. It was such an impressive natural wonder, standing alone here in the desert, a million-year-old sentinel. She supposed Muggles, too, would feel something in its presence.
This was a place of power for you once, wasn't it? She said.
It still is.
But Tsonsi barely glanced at the rock, while Alexandra continued staring at it until it was behind them.
Does that mean you can still use it to do magical rituals? Alexandra asked.
You think like a wizard, Tsotsi said.
Isn't that what you are? The Navajo shrugged. Not every Indian can do magic, right? You've got wizards and Muggles just like we do.
We don't call people who don't do magic Muggles.
Alexandra frowned and ate more of the breakfast burrito. They seemed to be heading northeast, getting on a state highway that bypassed Farewell and headed for the Colorado border. How far away is this Portkey anyway?
A little over 100 miles.
There's no Portkey anywhere closer?
We don't like Portkeys in Dineta. They make it easier for wizards to visit us.
No automagica either, I'll bet, Alexandra thought. She waited until she had finished her burrito before asking, Have you found John Mammolito?
I told you, leave that to us.
How about the thing that attacked me? Did you find bones or anything?
There was nothing left in the ashes. I don't know what sort of creature you fought, but it's burned up now. Maybe it was an elf.
Alexandra almost choked on her tea.
I wasn't imagining it. And Miss Tewawina wasn't imagining my injuries when she treated me.
I didn't say you imagined it. When we catch John Mammolito, we'll ask him what it was and let you know if you need any additional treatment. I hope Billy didn't fill your ears with stories about corpse sickness and nemesis spirits. She believes anything dark and evil where Navajo witches are concerned. As if Hopi witches are any better.
Alexandra would very much like to have asked about corpse sickness and nemesis spirits, but she was certain the Navajo Auror would not answer. So instead she said, So you haven't caught him? The Auror didn't say anything, and looked angry at having given that much away. Half an hour later, they were on a lonely desert highway with no other vehicles or signs of habitation in sight. Every now and then they passed a road sign or mile marker, and sometimes Alexandra could see small dwellings, wooden fences, or sheep in the distance, but it was an empty, sparsely inhabited land they were driving through. "I don't want to go home," Alexandra said, looking out the window. A minute passed. Then Sotsit said,
"Dineta is not a destination for runaways. We don't need outsiders coming here causing trouble."
"You know, I could actually be helpful."
"You've been very helpful. Vandalizing cars, burning down houses, attacking Aurors."
"That's not fair. You don't know the whole story, any of it. And if I were just a clueless outsider, how did I find John Mammolito's Dogon?"
Henry Tsotsi gave the appearance of thinking that over, then said, "So how did that turn out for you?"
"I didn't know John wouldn't be home."
"You mean you came all the way from Central Territory to Dineta to track down a Navajo witch in the middle of the desert, and it never occurred to you that he might not be sitting in his Hogan waiting for you to show up?"
"I was going to wait," she said, but Tsotsi cut her off again.
"You were going to wait, but since you're young, you chose not to. And instead you decided to go into the Hogan of a Navajo witch and trip every warden curse he left behind. And because you're such a talented young witch, you survived, but not without burning down the Hogan and destroying every piece of evidence we might have used to find out where John Mammolito is and what he's up to."
"I didn't know there was a Dineta Auror authority to contact."
"Just like you didn't know we had a trace office. I suppose you would have contacted us if you'd known."
Tsotsi looked at her, but then his eyes moved past her shoulder. Alexandra turned her head and something gray blurred past in the scrub along the side of the road.
"So the result of your adventure in the Indian territories is that after assaulting someone in Farewell..."
"He assaulted me!"
"How about that? A 14-year-old runaway running into trouble. So after assaulting someone and breaking into a motel room in Farewell, you came to Orange Rock and destroyed someone's car."
"They were assholes! I was minding my own business and they..."
"They what? Teased you? Made fun of the white girl?"
Tsotsi turned a narrow gaze on her.
"You seem very familiar with Muggle tools and culture. Did you grow up with non-magical people?"
"Yes."
"Have you ever been picked on by Muggles back home?"
Alexandra opened her mouth, but wasn't sure what to say.
"So when that happens," Tsotsi went on, "do you use your wand on them? Or do you only feel entitled to do that in Indian territory?"
Alexandra closed her mouth.
"Do you have any idea how much it costs to replace a car engine?"
Alexandra looked away.
"If it were up to me, we'd put you under an enemy's bane and keep you here as punishment. But Special Inquisitor Grimm wants you back. I hope she's got special plans for you."
Tsotsi sounded bitter, almost spiteful, though Alexandra wasn't sure whether it was directed at her or Diana Grimm. "I think the Dark Invention is going to do something tonight," Alexandra said, thinking about the map in her pocket. "I think John is planning something for the full moon."
"Witches often gather and perform rituals beneath the full moon. We know how to defend against that."
"Do you know where? Because I think I know where they're planning to gather."
"Did an elf tell you this too?"
"No." Alexandra folded her arms. The Auror obviously wasn't taking her seriously. Something came flapping at them. A black bird that dove at the truck and swerved away just in time to avoid being flattened against the windshield.
"Alexandra!"
screeched the bird, and then it was beating its wings furiously to try to keep up with them.
"Charlie!"
Alexandra shouted in disbelief.
"What?"
Tsotsi looked in the rearview mirror.
"Stop the truck! Stop!"
Alexandra almost grabbed the wheel before the Auror seized the front of her shirt and nearly slammed her against the passenger side door.
"Don't you ever do that while someone is driving, you crazy girl," he said.
She pried at his fingers.
"That's my familiar!" "What?"
"My familiar! My raven! Please stop!"
"You never told me you had a familiar with you."
I didn't! I left both my familiars back in Larkin Mills. I have no idea how Charlie got here, but it's Charlie, I know it is! Please, you wouldn't force me to leave my familiar behind, would you?"
Charlie was still flying after them, but a raven could not keep up with a vehicle on a highway, even if it wasn't the Automagica. "You just said you did leave your familiar behind."
But Tsotsi put his foot on the brake and pulled over to the side of the road. He drew his wand.
"Stay in the truck."
"It's just my familiar," Alexandra said.
"I don't care what you think. Ravens are deceitful creatures, and that may not be your familiar. Stay in the truck."
He snapped the last order out as Alexandra was about to open the door. He pointed his wand at her. She took her hand off the latch.
"Please don't hurt Charlie,"
she begged, so earnestly that the hardness around his eyes softened, just for a moment. He stepped out of the truck, and Alexandra watched fearfully as the Navajo faced the raven, who flew in a circle around them.
"Alexandra! Alexandra!"
Charlie called, and it was all Alexandra could do not to open the door and jump out. It was Charlie, she could feel it.
"I'll be damned," Tsotsi said after chanting a few words quietly under his breath. "Well, it's a raven, all right."
Alexandra didn't wait. She opened the door, ignored the Auror's scowl of annoyance, and stepped onto the shoulder of the road. "Charlie!" The raven landed on her outstretched arms, but pecked at her as she tried to pull her familiar closer to her.
"Wicked! Wicked! Wicked!"
"Missed you terrible," Alexandra said.
"Big fat jerk!"
Charlie took off and circled her again, cawing angrily.
"Talkative bird," Tsotsi said.
Alexandra knew Charlie would be angry at being left in Larkin Mills. She had assumed that her mother, Claudia, she corrected herself angrily, would at least feed and water her pets, not simply let them outside. She'd felt guilty every time she'd thought of them. That Charlie could find her, even in New Mexico, didn't surprise her that much, but she was mystified by the bird's agitation. It wasn't just the resentment she had expected. Charlie was disturbed by something. It was almost as if the raven was trying to warn them. "Something's wrong," she said.
"Wicked!"
Charlie said, and landed on the hood of the truck and cawed.
"Fly, fly!"
"Get in the truck," Tsotsi said. "I don't like ravens. If it's coming along, you'd better silence it."
"Ravens are wise birds," Alexandra said. "I think Charlie is trying to warn us about something."
"Fly, fly!"
Charlie said. To her surprise, the Auror didn't scoff at her or order her into the truck again. Instead, he studied Charlie, then reached for his leather pouch. He turned it upside down, and Charlie screeched and took off as the large rattlesnake slid out onto the metal hood, coiled, raised its head to taste the air with its tongue, and began shaking its tail. Tsotsi looked down the road in the direction the snake was flicking its tongue. Alexandra could see only more highway and endless desert, and mountains on the horizon.
"Something is wrong," Tsotsi said.
"Duh," Alexandra said. "How come you believe your snake but not my raven?" Tsotsi eyed her.
"You don't know the kind of magic I'm using, and you sure don't know how to talk to snakes."
"How do you know? Maybe I can talk to snakes." Alexandra had taken a few steps back, because she didn't like being within striking range of an agitated rattlesnake, but she watched it with interest. "You have a link with it, just like I have a link with my familiars."
"It's not a familiar," Tsotsi said.
"Whatever." Tsotsi grabbed the snake as if unconcerned that it might strike, but Alexandra noticed that he grabbed it behind its head before pushing it back into his leather pouch.
"Get in the truck," he said. "Now."
She got in and pleaded with Charlie.
"Come on, Charlie."
She was worried Charlie might not come, either for fear of the snake or anger at her, but the raven landed in her lap and pecked at her arms.
"Wicked! Wicked!"
She slammed the door shut before Charlie could take off again, and to her surprise, Tsotsi jerked on the wheel and kicked dirt up as he swung the truck around to point back the way they'd come.
"Where are we going?" she asked. "Do you know how to cast a silencing charm?"
He floored the accelerator, throwing her back against the seat. Charlie's flapping wings buffeted her face.
"Quiet, Charlie," she murmured, holding the raven against her despite the bird's protests.
Tsotsi slammed on the brakes again, almost sending Alexandra pitching into the dashboard. She still hadn't fastened her seatbelt. Someone was standing in the road ahead of them. Two, then three more people materialized out of the air. One was a woman, the others were men. All of them were Navajos, dressed in rugged outdoor wear. Coats and jackets, hats and headbands, boots and leather shoes, except for one man. He was bare-chested except for a silver necklace beneath a brown cloak of animal pelts. He wore leggings, deer hide wrapped around his calves and tied in place with bandanas and moccasins. Standing among the other Indians, who were dressed more modernly and practically, he seemed completely out of place, but the cold didn't seem to bother him.
"Alexandra, quick," the bare-chested man said, grinning with feral delight. "It is you."
Alexandra's blood ran hot and cold.
"John!"
"Wicked!"
Charlie cried.
"Stay in the truck," Tsotsi said.
"What are you going to do?" Alexandra saw that all of the Indians were holding wands and wished desperately that she had her own.
"Stay," he repeated, in a tone one might use to order a dog.
Alexandra bristled and held Charlie close to her while the Auror got out of the truck and faced the group.
Have you all taken up the witchery way?
He asked.
You've joined this Antrini.
He gestured with contempt at John.
You call any magic your grandfather didn't teach you witchery, John said.
Is this the witch who's been cursing people all over the reservation?
One of the men asked, pointing at Alexandra.
No,
Tsotsi said.
She's just a white girl who wandered off her own reservation.
Why are you protecting this Bilagana?
The woman in the group demanded. She wore pants and a cotton shirt beneath a long duster, and she held her wand in a gloved hand. There were streaks of silver in her long black hair, and she might have seemed grandmotherly except for her vicious expression. An argument in Navajo commenced. Alexandra couldn't understand any of it, except that she was obviously the topic being debated, and while Henry Tsotsi tried to reason with the yelling group, John Manmolito said nothing, merely folded his arms and regarded them all with a look of smug satisfaction. She glared at him, wishing she had her wand. He gave her a slow wink. Charlie flapped and beat wings against her face again, shrieking,
"Wicked! Wicked!"
"I know, Charlie," she said. Charlie pecked at her ear, and when she yelped, the raven pecked the little glass window looking out the back of the truck's cab. She turned, and what she saw made her grow cold. A gray, yellow-eyed coyote and two black owls were sitting on either side of the road behind them. The coyote crouched low and began padding toward the truck. Alexandra slid across the seat to the driver's side.
"Hand her over!" shouted one of the men in English. "Let us put an end to the evil she's responsible for!"
"She's not responsible for any evil," Tsotsi said.
John spoke up for the first time since the argument began.
"Don't you get tired of protecting white people and following their rules?"
He said this with the smirk of someone standing at the edge of a fire and poking it with a stick.
"This is the boy who went to the white man's school and brought the white man's evil back to us. All of you are letting this two-heart poison your minds. He's the one performing witchery way ceremonies. Stop listening to his voice whispering in your ears and listen to the truth."
Then he switched back to Navajo. But when Alexandra stepped out of the truck, he hissed at her,
"I told you to stay in the truck. Behind us," she said. "Did you think I didn't notice?"
He grabbed her roughly and started to shove her back into the truck. But at that moment, one of the men on the road raised his wand. The Auror blocked the black bolt that shot from the other man's wand, but the silver and black-haired woman whipped her wand in a circle, and all four tires of the truck burst. One of the other men cast a levitation spell that flipped the truck onto its side. Tsotsi bellowed,
"Protego Totalis!"
Hexes and curses rebounded off his golden shield and struck the road, melting holes in the asphalt or shattering into black beads. Charlie flew out of the half-open door that was now facing the sky. The owls that had been sitting by the roadside snapped alert. One spread its dark, mottled wings and rose into the air after the raven.
"Give me my wand!"
Alexandra said to Tsotsi. As he kept a hand around her arm while countering the spells the mob was casting at them, John remained standing where he was, but the others were circling around him, and Alexandra could see the Auror couldn't deflect attacks from all directions.
"Not a chance,"
Tsotsi said. The coyote had almost reached the truck before the vehicle flipped over, and it was now crouching to spring at them. Tsotsi uttered something in Navajo while pointing his wand, and the coyote yelped and rolled to the ground, pawing at its mouth, which was suddenly full of fizzy green foam. One of the men threw a stunner at Tsotsi, having edged around his shield spell, and the Auror deflected it back at him, but the man jumped aside. John was raising his arms. Alexandra pleaded with Tsotsi,
"I know how to duel. Don't leave me helpless while they're trying to kill me. At least let me shield myself so you don't have to."
She watched in agony as the owl continued ascending in pursuit of Charlie, talons extended. Tsotsi threw both of them to the ground as one of the men conjured a swarm of bees. The air vibrated as they hummed overhead. Tsotsi thrust his arm straight into their midst and rotated it, and a whirlwind roared around them, lifting their hair and blowing the bees in all directions. He rolled off of Alexandra and reached into his jacket with a grimace.
"Protect yourself only," he said. "These people have been witched."
His fist emerged from his coat, clenching her wand, and he pressed it against her chest and thrust her to the ground with a thump. He fixed his eyes on hers for just a moment, even as he made two of the Indian wizards duck a spell from his own wand.
"Hurt them, and I swear I will see that you never do magic again."
Pinned to the ground with the Navajo Auror leaning over her, Alexandra nodded. He relaxed his grip, and she snatched her wand from his hand even as he rose, and spoke something that sounded like a cough.
Hot red clouds billowed out of his wand and engulfed the nearest man, who covered his face with a sleeve and began sneezing and choking. The earth shook, but Alexandra staggered to her feet anyway, pointed her wand skyward and said, "Barak!" It wasn't a dueling spell, but one her brother had taught her. Lightning flashed from her wand, and her arm was momentarily ablaze. Throwing real lightning was dangerous, and Alexandra hadn't mastered it. But the owl fell from the sky, trailing smoke. Alexandra winced when it turned into a man just before hitting the ground. 2 yards away, the coyote had regained its feet and crouched, growling at her. She pointed her wand, with smoke still rising from her sleeve. "Run," she said. The thud of the other shapeshifter hitting the ground echoed in her ears, and her arm hurt as if she had been the one hit by lightning, but her voice didn't quaver, and her expression was flat and cold. The coyote's ears flattened, and with a whimper, it fled, tail between its legs. Alexandra felt relief and a small sense of victory before the ground buckled underneath her and rose up, throwing her off her feet and almost throwing the truck on top of her. The highway was rippling as if a great wave were passing beneath it, and then something rose out of the ground on the other side of the road, a massive head, arrow-shaped and blunt-nosed like a great serpent, but made of rock. Stone fangs hung from the roof of its mouth like stalactites, each the length of Alexandra's leg. Lying on her back, she stared up at it and wondered if a lightning bolt would have any effect whatsoever. She thought of shattering charms, severing charms, even Kaitaris, and was sure none would be sufficient. This sort of magic needed to be undone directly, and all she knew how to undo were minor curses and jinxes. Whatever spell John Mammolito had cast over the other people attacking them seemed to have been broken by the stone serpent's appearance. They, too, were fleeing. She saw Charlie wheeling in the sky. She cast a shield charm. Henry Tonsi did the same. She sprang to her feet and leaped as the snake struck. The shield charms deflected it by an arm's length, and that plus the 7-league boots carried Alexandra out of its path before it bit a car-sized chunk out of the road. She almost knocked the Auror off his feet as she sailed into him and rebounded, but she was the one knocked flat on her back. He gave her an odd look, then began chanting as he held up his leather pouch. Kind of an uneven match, she thought dizzily, as the rattlesnake fell from Sotsi's pouch to the ground. But as Sotsi continued chanting, the rattlesnake swelled in size. As the stone serpent slithered sideways, tearing up the road beneath it, the real serpent became the size of a python, then larger than the largest python that ever lived, and then by the time the stone snake had raised its head high above the highway to strike again, the rattlesnake was nearly as large as it was. The two snakes crashed together, their coils wrapping around one another, and the massive rattle of Tsotsi's snake swept them both off the highway just before the stone tail of the other snake smashed into the asphalt. Alexandra coughed and rolled onto her side. Tsotsi was pointing his wand at her, and for a moment she thought he was about to hex her. Then he said, "Petrificus Totalus!" And a man crashed to the ground at her feet, holding a knife in one hand and a wand in the other. He looked incompletely transformed, with his head rounded and squat on his shoulders, his neck non-existent and still sprouting downy black owl feathers, and his hands twisted into gnarled claws. Alexandra stood up and saw John Mammolito watching them from across the highway. The other people who'd come with him, except for the shapeshifters, were stunned or unconscious on the ground. Alexandra cast darts and fireballs at John, but he apparated out of the way, and when he reappeared, he was even further away. She looked over his shoulder. The giant snakes were still thrashing about in a deathlock, and she had no idea which one was winning. Henry Tsotsi got to his feet.
"You're a coward!"
he yelled at the younger Navajo.
"A black, two-hearted coward! You brought contagion and sickness to Dineta!"
He added something in Navajo, which made Alexandra think of the time she'd heard Anna curse in Chinese. John laughed.
"Wolves and sheep, Henry Tsotsi. Everyone is one or the other. You rolled over for the Bilegana wolves like all the other Diné who lick colonial boots."
Tsotsi growled.
"What do your friends call themselves? The Dark Convention? Tell me about rolling over for Bilegana wolves, John Mammolito. You're not even a proper Antine. You have to use white man's magic for your witchcraft."
"Whatever works," John said.
"You and your fellow Auros can't protect the Diné. And you can't protect that little bitch!"
He flicked his wand at Alexandra and laughed when she tensed, prepared to deflect a spell.
"You can't even protect yourselves! You'll see!"
Tsotsi threw a spell that howled and screeched through the air like a hailstorm, a windstorm, and a thunderbolt all wrapped into a single roaring flame of pulsating air, and when it struck, the ground erupted and rained black ice and muddy water for yards around. Alexander was impressed at the speed with which the aura cast such a spell, but Ja Mamolito disappeared an instant before it touched the earth.
"Aren't you a dutiful Navajo?"
John yelled, this time from somewhere out in the desert. Alexandra and Tsotsi both turned with their wands at the ready, but the crashing and scraping from the giant snake's battle made it hard to tell where his voice was coming from.
"Protecting a girl who's already dead!"
There was a cracking, crumbling sound. Chunks of stone rained down upon the road as the giant rattlesnake crushed its opponent in its grip. In seconds, the battle was over, and Alexandra and Tsotsi faced a snake the size of a dragon, sitting coiled atop a pile of rocks, enormous tail held in the air at the height of a telephone pole, buzzing loudly enough to deafen them both. A caw distracted it. It looked skyward, where Charlie was still circling overhead. Henry Tsotsi stepped forward and raised both hands. He began speaking calmly in Navajo, and the snake turned its attention back on him. If that's not his familiar, he'd better be really good at transfigurations, Alexandra thought. The snake began to shrink, and then as quickly as if it were a mirage vanishing off the highway, it was gone. The snake Tsotsi picked up off the pile of rubble and put back in his pouch seemed a tiny, insignificant thing by comparison. Alexandra swallowed as she looked around at all the destruction. The overturned truck, the unconscious bodies, the torn and shattered highway, and the owl anamorphagus she'd blasted out of the sky. It was that body that drew her attention as she looked at her wand and wondered what else she should have done. Tsotsi went over to the man and knelt by him. He put a hand on the man's back and waved his wand, chanting a spell she didn't recognize.
"You didn't kill him," he said, "but not for lack of trying."
He walked back over to her and his expression was angry.
"What did I tell you?"
"You told me not to hurt the people who've been bewitched. He was one of the witches, and I was defending myself. If he hurt my familiar, I could have been hurt." The defense sprang to her lips despite her relief at knowing she hadn't killed the man. "They were trying to kill me. Why? I haven't been cursing anyone."
"John Mamolita was the one stirring up trouble. You made a convenient scapegoat."
The Auror began levitating each of the other Navajos to the side of the road and laying them side by side, except for the man who'd come in the form of owls. Charlie landed on her shoulder. She scanned the horizon. "The coyote got away."
"I noticed that."
Tsotsi sounded weary. He pointed at a spot by the truck.
"Stand there, and don't move."
"What are we going to do?" she asked, without moving to the spot he indicated. He was checking each of the unconscious people, loosening a few of their neck scarves and pouring a little water onto the lips of the woman.
"I've already called my fellow orders. They'll be here shortly."
"How did you call them?"
"Smoke signals," he snapped at her. "Would you just do as you're told?"
She walked slowly to the side of the truck. "John and his friends are going to do something tonight, under the full moon. Whether I'm here or not, you will not be here. If I have to personally ride a bus with you back to Chicago." "Would you listen to me? I have a map of the Four Corners where they..." He gave her such a wrathful look that she took a step back. Charlie squawked.
"I don't care if you have a map of the lands below," he said. "One more word, and I'll take away your mouth."
"I'm sorry," Alexandra said breathlessly, "but you all need to get out of here."
"You need to get out of here,"
one of the men said. His brow was covered with sweat. "Listen to me," Alexandra said. The woman outside, I don't know what's going on, but she's dead."
"Yaji is dead?"
Another of the men stood. He, too, was sweating profusely.
"How? What happened?"
Everyone looked even more horrified. "A witch killed her," Alexandra said. She realized belatedly that she was still holding her wand. She hoped she wouldn't have to spend a lot of time trying to differentiate between herself and a Navajo witch. From the looks the Indians were giving her, it was obvious that the sudden appearance of a Bilagana girl did not inspire trust, with or without a wand.
"A witch,"
said the man who'd stood. He groaned and began to shudder.
More might come," Alexandra said. "You need to leave."
"We can't."
The man fell to his knees and whimpered.
"Young girl,"
said the man missing an arm.
"You're the one who needs to leave, now."
Alexandra shook her head. "You don't understand. These people are wizards, dark wizards. They kill people and they'll kill..." She stopped talking when the one-armed man groaned and rolled his head around. Drool spilled from his mouth and his eyes rolled back in his head,
The man on the floor twisted and writhed in pain. The little boy began crying. The old woman put her arms around him and comforted him, though she was grimacing in pain herself.
"Get out of here!"
the fat teenage girl screamed, showing her scars again. They were pulsing now, red and livid as if fresh.
"If Yaji Red Horse is dead, who will keep us in?" asked the oldest man.
He was the most composed of all of them, though he too was beginning to tremble and sweat. "Keep you in?" A terrible realization pierced Alexandra's confusion and horror as she watched the group of people before her groaning, sweating, and squirming in pain. The man who'd fallen to the ground raised his head. His eyes had become different, animalistic, and when he forced words out, his teeth were unnaturally large and sharp.
"We came here so we wouldn't hurt anyone," he panted. "Yaji Red Horse and the other medicine men and women keep us safe.
They keep everyone safe from us,"
the old man said. He coughed, except it wasn't a cough. It was something clawing its way out of him, like a beast within forcing itself through his skin. His forehead began collapsing.
"Please get out of here,"
the girl repeated, crying now. And then she shrieked and put her hands to her face as her jaw swelled and stretched. Alexandra watched, stunned.
"You're werewolves."
The man on the ground groaned. His groan turned into a growl. He extended a hand toward her, a hand grown hairy and adorned with long, bestial nails. His eyes were black and yellow and feral.
"Run!"
he snarled. Alexandra was already backing out the door. She turned and ran. Surreptitiously, Alexandra ran her hands along her front and sides. She could not feel any pockets or the presence of her wand. "Your things are outside," Billy whispered in her ear. "Come on." She led Alexandra to a wooden door and they stepped outside, into the cold air of the desert beneath the morning sun. The shock after stepping out of the sauna within made her feel faint. Alexandra was grateful for Billy's hand at her elbow, though she managed not to stumble. They were in some completely different part of the desert, this one all white stones and occasional thorny plants. There were mountains in the distance, as everywhere else Alexandra had seen in Dineta, but no other familiar landmarks. She could be anywhere in the Indian Territory, she thought. The only person waiting outside was Henry Tsotsi, sitting behind the wheel of his truck, which was in remarkably good condition, considering the last time she'd seen it was after a giant stone snake had flipped it over on the highway.
"Alexandra!"
Alexandra held out her arms as Charlie flew from the roof of Tsotsi's cab to her arms. She held the raven and took long, deep breaths. "Henry has your wand," Billy said. "You might want to wash up and get dressed." She indicated a second building, smaller than the first, made of wood. "Was I unconscious?" Alexandra asked. "You were very feverish, so you probably don't remember much." "That was some kind of healing ritual for ghost sickness?" "Yes." "What about Johnny and Trish? Who's that other guy?" "They'll be all right. But the boy and the girl were touched worse than you, and they don't have their own magic, so the ceremony will be longer for them. The other man was one of the Aurors who went to get you." Billy clucked her tongue. She didn't seem inclined to answer other questions, so Alexandra went into the wooden shack, which turned out to be an outhouse, though a remarkably clean-smelling one. It had a partition separating the toilet from a tub full of hot water and a basket with another set of clean clothes for her. She washed herself off with the cloth provided and got dressed, relieved to find that her magical boots were also in the basket. She didn't see her backpack. She walked outside and realized she was still weak, very hungry, and even more thirsty. Billy was standing next to Henry Tsotsi's truck, speaking to him through his rolled-down window. When Alexandra reached the truck, the Navajo Aura gestured at her to get in. She did so, making sure Charlie entered as well. Charlie immediately perched on the dashboard. "You're a brave girl, Alexandra," Billy said. "Good luck."
"Thanks."
Alexandra was nonplussed. "You're sure Johnny and Trish will be all right?" "I'm going back inside to take care of them." The Hopi healer waved a hand and walked back into the Hogan. Henry Tsotsi hadn't said a word to her yet. He handed her a canteen. Alexandra didn't ask what was in it. She just took it and drank. The water was ice cold and delicious. After gulping down half the canteen, she wiped her mouth and asked, "Now what?" He took the canteen back.
"Now I take you to the Portkey station and send you home, like I was trying to do before."
"Just like that?"
"Haven't you spent enough time in Dineta? That bird can't sit on the dashboard."
He started the truck. Alexandra reached for Charlie. "Have you ever tried keeping a raven in your lap?"
"Keep it off the dashboard or it's going to have to fly outside."
"Big fat jerk,"
Charlie said. Alexandra cradled the raven under one arm. Charlie fussed and squawked, but settled down a little after a few minutes, while the truck rolled over hard stones until it reached an unmarked dirt road. They began bumping over rocks and around sagebrush and thorn bushes. They went almost a mile before Sotsi spoke again.
"I suppose you're hungry."
"A little." In fact, Alexandra was starving. Charlie was making sounds in response to the rumble of her stomach.
"We'll stop and get something to eat. It's about an hour until we hit 64. Are you going to starve to death before then?"
"What if I was? Would you apparate us or conjure some food?"
"You can't conjure food. Don't they teach you that at Charmbridge Academy?"
"Speaking of which, are you going to give me my wand back?" She expected him to tell her he'd give it to her when they reached the Portkey station, or not answer at all. She was surprised when, after a moment of silence, he slid it out of the pocket inside his coat and handed it to her.
"Thank you," she said.
She looked back through the window of the cab at the back of the trunk, but it was covered with a tarp.
"Your backpack is there,"
Tsotsi said.
"The skyhook is in it."
Alexandra settled into the seat and let him drive for a while. The desert didn't change much, and it was blindingly bright. She squinted, thinking about everything that had happened the previous night. "What happened to the werewolves?" she asked at last.
"We rounded them up before they attacked anyone."
"What about the Dark Convention warlocks? I mean, the Navajo witches. John Mambolito's friends?"
"In custody."
"And John?" Tsotsi pursed his lips.
"We're still looking for him."
Alexandra closed her eyes and sighed. They passed a few more hogans and wooden houses, and once a trailer. Occasionally, there were Navajos outside, watching them go by. Once, they had to stop to let a flock of sheep move past. A dog kept the sheep together, and an old man nodded to Henry Tsotsi as he followed the animals. After another half an hour, Tsotsi spoke again.
"What you did was very foolish."
Alexandra looked out the window and didn't answer.
"What were you expecting to find at that stone hogan?"
he asked. "John Mambolito."
"You shouldn't have gone there by yourself. You should have told me that John Mambolito knew about that place. Your jivered horse is dead."
"I tried to tell you," Alexandra snapped. "You wouldn't listen to me. I had no idea what some spot on a map was. I didn't know it was a jail for werewolves."
"Not a jail. After they transform, they're free to run and howl outside, but are kept within lines we draw in the desert. And other charms keep any ordinary folk away."
"Until the Dark Convention showed up and killed Miss Renhorse? I saw her killed. If you'd listened to me, maybe you would have warned her, but you just wanted to get rid of me and wouldn't listen to anything I said."
"It was very foolish for you to take on a coven of witches."
"What would have happened if I hadn't been there?"
Tsotsi was quiet for a long time after that. Finally, he said,
"The witches were going to take the shapeshifters, the lycanthropes, and set them loose near Little Creek or another town. You prevented that."
Alexandra petted Charlie, who was squirming beneath her arm. Tsotsi said,
"I don't quite understand why the two men you left unconscious by the stone hogan weren't touched."
"I kind of distracted the werewolves to get them to chase me."
"You figured you could outrun them with those magical boots of yours."
Alexandra looked down at her feet, then shrugged. "Your werewolves didn't seem to be preventing from crossing any lines in the desert."
"Killing Yachi destroyed the wards. Most Navajo magic is tainted by death. Why did you save those kids?"
"What, I'm just going to leave them to get eaten by werewolves?" When he didn't answer, she muttered, "You really do think I'm just a trial and a pain, don't you?" Tsotsi was silent again for a while. Alexandra was becoming very hungry, and she was relieved when she finally saw a small two-lane highway. Tsotsi turned onto it, and the truck picked up speed. "I was expecting your trace office would notice me casting spells and someone would come get me," Alexandra said. "That was my plan. I'd find out what John Mammolito and his coven were up to out there, and then I'd cast some spells, and you'd know where I was and show up and arrest him. That was your plan, huh? Alexandra couldn't read the Auror's expression. More or less. They went past a sign that said Farewell was 90 miles ahead. Occasionally they passed other vehicles, mostly driven by Indians.
Finding a runaway teenager was actually not at the top of our priority list, Tsotsi said. The Dark Convention, John Mambolito and his fellow Antini, and some Bilegano warlocks as well, did a lot of damage all over the Indian territories last night. They even tried to call Chinti from Orange Rock itself, but they were counting on the few Auroras in Dineta to be even busier than we were, with werewolves running loose and whatever ritual they were going to perform on top of Witch's Rock. What John Mammolito did wasn't nearly as bad as what they probably planned to do.
Tsotsi glanced at Alexandra again.
He cut one man's throat, but the other one was cut along the thigh. Can you explain that? Your two friends weren't able to give us many details about what happened on Witch's Rock.
John cut both their throats. I used a wound relocating charm on the first man. I didn't reach the second man in time. Tsotsi considered this.
A wound relocating charm is classified as dark arts.
You going to add it to the list of things the Wizard Justice Department is going to charge me with? A small town materialized on the road ahead. It wasn't much more than a collection of houses and a gas station and convenience store, but Alexandra's stomach rumbled at the prospect of food. They stopped at the convenience store. Tsotsi brought her a sandwich, an apple, and a bottle of green tea. Alexandra tried not to eat too quickly. Her stomach almost rebelled against the food, as if it had been days since she'd eaten last. She'd finished most of the sandwich before they even got back to the truck. She spared a corner of the sandwich for Charlie, whom they had left locked in the cab. The raven devoured the scraps greedily, while Alexandra tried not to feel covetous of those last few bites. She began eating the apple. Tsotsi didn't speak again until they were once more on the road with the town behind them.
It's not your fault Yanji Red Horse is dead, he said. She was a friend of mine. What happened last night? A lot of things that happened last night were terrible. There have always been a few witches making trouble in Dineta, just like anywhere else, but we didn't realize that John Mambolito had brought so many outsiders here. The Dark Convention is more active in the Indian territories than we thought. It's going to cause a lot of problems for us. From them, and from the Wizard Justice Department.
Oh. Alexandra wasn't sure what to say. What do they want in the Indian territories?
I imagine to stir up old ghosts, cause trouble, unleash evil magic. Who knows what the Dark Convention wants, or why Antini do the things they do.
Alexandra thought Tsotsi wasn't being entirely honest with her. He was an Auror and surely knew more than he was telling her, but telling her anything at all was an improvement. So nobody was killed? Besides Miss Redhorse and the dead Antini? Tsotsi looked at her again. Some others were killed.
Oh.
Alexandra wondered if the Auror would expand on that, and wasn't surprised when he didn't.
You did some good, Tsotsi said. You saved Johnny Thompson and Patricia Peshlakai. That was very brave.
Are they going to remember everything? She asked.
Did you really threaten to steal their hearts and turn them into beetles?
Only to scare them. I mean, to make them move faster. I was trying to save them from the werewolves.
I see.
The Auror nodded slowly.
Well, you did do that.
They saw everything. Werewolves and witches and Chindi. Tsotsi's face was stone.
And you think they should be obliterated because they're Muggles?
I don't think that, but the Confederation makes a big deal out of the International Statute of Wizarding Secrecy.
Yes.
Alexander wasn't sure what his tone signified. I don't like it. I understand why we have to keep magic secret. A lot of people would freak out if they knew magic was real, but I don't like obliviators going around erasing memories. She fell into a brooding silence, thinking of Hecate Grimm. Tsotsi said in a careful tone of voice,
We try to take care of our own people. We never kept magic a secret before the Confederation came.
Alexandra thought about that. How will you keep Trish and Johnny from telling everyone?
You don't need to worry about that.
He paused.
We can't hide the fact that two muggles were exposed to the wizarding world, but my official reports don't need to mention every detail. For example, I didn't list everything you did that wasn't so helpful while you were in Dineta. Like destroying a car engine, assaulting an Auror, and fleeing from custody. So, those are things you probably don't need to tell them.
Thanks, she said uncertainly.
And probably the less you say about Johnny Thompson and Patricia Peshlakai, the better. I am not telling you to lie to anyone, especially not a Special Inquisitor. But there's a difference between telling the truth and saying things that aren't important.
I understand, I think. Alexandra rolled down the window and tossed the apple core out. Tsotsi frowned at her while she rolled up the window again. I'll pay for the damage to Ron Pete's car, she said.
Huh, he grunted. Will you? You have a couple $1,000s?
She thought about the account her father had given her. She'd have to go to the Colonial Bank of the New World to convert some of it into dollars, but... If I send the money to you, will you make sure he gets it?
Sure.
Tsotsi was unmoved, and Alexandra sensed his skepticism. You don't believe I will, do you? He shrugged.
We're used to white people coming on the reservation and making messes we have to clean up.
Alexandra slid lower in her seat. I'm sorry I caused you so much trouble. I just wanted to stop John Mammolito. He killed a friend of mine and almost killed another, and he tried to kill me. I didn't come here to make trouble for you or get anyone hurt. She wasn't sure, but it seemed the hard lines of Henry Tsotsi's face softened a little. They spoke little after that. They drove through Farewell, came to another highway, and proceeded northeast, entering the mountains and crossing the Colorado border. Alexandra had been nodding off, and Charlie was quiescent in her arms, when Tsotsi said,
Portkey Station's up ahead.
Alexandra sat up. The desert had been cold but dry, but now they were surrounded by snow. The highway, salted and plowed recently, cut a ribbon of black through the snow-covered rocks around them, but the only thing ahead of them was an unattended highway rest area.
It's not a public station, like in Chicago or New Amsterdam, Tsotsi said. It's for official Confederation use only.
They pulled off the highway and parked in the lot, tires crunching over snow that had fallen since the lot had last been plowed. There were a couple of other cars there and a truck. Unlike Henry Tsotsi's truck, the other vehicles had chains on their tires. A couple of people who were checking a map in their car stared at the white-haired girl with the raven in the company of a tall Indian man. Alexandra tugged at her white bangs. Can you fix my hair? Tsotsi answered seriously.
You want me to wave my wand right here?
Of course not, she frowned at him. I mean before you send me back.
I'm sure Diana Grimm or one of your teachers at that fancy school of yours can undo a little curse like that.
He took her backpack out of the trunk and handed it to her. She snatched it angrily. That truck driver was right.
Truck driver?
The Navajo Auror glanced, puzzled, at the semi-truck that was sitting by a snowbank on the other side of the small parking lot. About Navajo cops? Alexandra pushed her arms through the straps and cinched the pack on her back. Tsotsi gave her another of his long looks, then led her to a pavilion that sheltered a giant road map behind thick plastic, a rack full of tourist brochures, and a small building with men and women's restrooms and an unmarked door between them. The Auror paused before the unmarked door.
You're a dog, he said.
Alexandra was confused, then she colored. Are you calling me a bitch?
What? No.
For the first time, Tsotsi's equanimity was ruffled. I wouldn't call someone that. He shook his head.
What John Mammolito said about wolves and sheep is true, from his point of view. That's how he thinks. There are people who are wolves and prey on the weak, and people who are their victims. But there is another kind of person. The kind of person who protects the sheep from the wolves. The sheepdogs.
Kind of like Aurors, Alexandra said. Tsotsi smiled wryly.
You could say that. You're a brave girl. A troublesome juvenile delinquent. But a brave girl.
Alexandra found this almost touching. If you catch John Mammolito or find out anything about his whereabouts, will you let me know? Tsotsi's expression went flat again.
Let you know?
You're an Auror. Can't you get a message to me, Kara Chambers Academy? He sighed. When we find John Mambolito, I'll let you know. He tapped his wand against the unmarked door and it opened. There are two coffee cans on the top shelf. Make sure to put your raven in the first one before you touch the second. He caught her arm just before she stepped inside. If I ever see you in Dinetai again, I'll turn you into a snake and put you in my pouch. Alexandra said nothing when he released her. She stepped inside and found the coffee can sitting on the shelf over an ordinary industrial sink in a room filled with cleaning supplies, tools, and trash cans. Sorry, Charlie. She knew how much animals hated travel by portkey. She pushed the protesting bird into one of the cans and sucked in her breath when the can disappeared, taking Charlie with it. Then she let out the rest of her breath and grabbed the second can and was yanked through space, away from Dineta.